This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Hurricane Irma is now a Category 4 storm, but with winds raging near 150 miles per hour, the downgrade from a Category 5 to now a 4 does not diminish the threat that this powerful storm poses to Florida. And as forecasters get more data on the storm's path, it's looking like it's drifting ever so slightly westward, closer to southwest Florida. Here to give us the latest is meteorologist Jeff Huffman with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, we've been getting updates from you and your team all week about Hurricane Irma, but we've seen some alarming changes yesterday afternoon and then late this morning with gradual shifts to the west. What's the latest?
Yeah, good afternoon, Julie. These alarming changes, keep in mind, are very common this far out still. These fluctuations in the track and the intensity, that happens with major hurricanes. But this particular shift is certainly one that produces more impacts and more direct impacts there in southwest Florida, at least as of the official forecast at 11 o'clock from the National Hurricane Center. If you were to draw a line down the center of the peninsula of Florida and split it left or right, it's likely to come ashore now, according to the official forecast, just left or just west of that line, likely over the Everglades there of southwest Florida.
At what time, when are we anticipating this getting to, for example, Everglades City, Collier County, Lee County?
Well, it depends on what you're asking. Tropical storm force winds, hurricane force winds, or the eye? Which one are you referring to?
Any or all of the above.
Okay. I should have known that was coming. So we're talking about tropical storm force winds could occur as early as mid-morning to late morning there in Fort Myers, but it's more likely to occur late afternoon. Tropical storm force winds, the hurricane force winds with the eye passing very close or just to the east of Fort Myers, those winds are likely to begin by daybreak Sunday morning. So for procrastinators and those who thought this was going east, and I know there's a lot of you, it's almost too late to finish those evacuations, but it is not too late just yet to finish the evacuations and the preparations. But just know that when this starts to happen tomorrow, it will be too late, and you're going to have to shelter in place as it moves across. And that, I think, that critical moment to make, you got to decide probably by this evening, Julie, because we know that the time it would take to get to a safe location now is almost probably three times as much as it would take or would have taken a couple of days ago.
Yeah, the traffic is a nightmare out there. But
not to mention, Julie. Not to mention, sorry to cut you off, but not to mention, not just the traffic. There's a limited number of places to go now. Anywhere you have to travel a long, long way just to find a place if you're choosing not to ride this out in a shelter. I just wanted to say that.
Exactly. So with this eye going over land for a little bit more time, of course, it's going over the Everglades. Will that have any impact in possibly diminishing the power of this thing?
Well, keep in mind, the Everglades are
water.
A large swamp, yeah, and they're flat. We have something called the brown soil effect or the brown, I forgot the exact name that scientists have theorized about this. It's very common in Texas. But what happens here is that the hurricane can still feed off of very wet ground, even though it's inland. It can still feed off. In fact, Julie, it's important to remember that the water source, the source of energy and heat for this storm, is not very far away from it, no matter where it is in Florida. It's going to pull in and suck in all that moisture from all sides. So this will not weaken fast. Even our listeners and maybe those traveling up 75, up toward Bradenton and up toward Sarasota, and especially anybody who tried to go inland toward the Lake Okeechobee area or maybe up toward Lakeland, there's going to be significant impacts from this right up the spine of the peninsula for many, many hours and many, many miles after landfall.
Are there any chances at this point of it going further west or further east? Is there any, what are the chances of it turning off of the current path?
Well, as we go forward in time and as we move closer to landfall, the chances of a fluctuation, significant fluctuation, are diminishing. It is, I'm looking at the cone right here on my screen, you know, the cone of uncertainty, even at this moment, still is wider than the peninsula. So there's still a chance that this will shift. That's an average error over the course of, I think, 10 years is what that cone is, or how we determine that, or how the Hurricane Center draws that cone. So there's still a chance. But the data that I'm seeing, and I'm still getting the noon or the midday model runs in, but I'm looking at most of the reliable ones, and they're all pretty centered around now this potential landfall in southwest Florida. And Julie, remember, when we're this far into the ballgame here, it's not so much a matter of this model says that or this model says this. all the models tend to shift together because they're all now starting to see very good quality of data. So, you know, the GFS and the Euro both have made some of the same shifts in the last 24 hours, and it's very possible that both of them may make another shift in the next 24.
All right. Well, thank you, as always, meteorologist Jeff Huffman. Stay safe and rested. It's going to be a long weekend.
And you do the same, and we'll continue updating you on our mobile app, Florida Storms, as well, Julie.
Exactly. Thank you so much.
Yep.
While there are mandatory and voluntary evacuations being called for up and down Florida, there are those who will not be evacuating due to their career calling. Those are our emergency and medical personnel. Here to talk about staffing at local hospitals is Lisa Scarlatta, the Chief Patient Care Officer at Lee Health. Lisa, thanks for being part of the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Also with us now is Ben Abies, the Lee County EMS Chief. Thanks for taking time out of what I'm sure is a hectic day.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
So Ben, emergency responders posted a news conference on Facebook Live last night talking about, well, actually yesterday afternoon, talking about how emergencies are handled at the height of a storm. At what point does it become too dangerous for first responders to go out in an ambulance or a fire engine?
Our standards are that as soon as tropical storm force winds or sustained winds at about 40 miles per hour are felt within the county, that those operations cease. And in a tropical storm, those timings can vary. In the scenario we're facing now, we're looking at a prolonged period of time where we would have to suspend those operations.
What do emergency responders advise people do when 911 isn't able to send anyone? I mean, we've done stories before with 911 personnel, and they're very highly trained to talk people through things until help can arrive. Will they have advice to give, or will they be able to hold on the line, or are they going to be taking messages and sending people out once it's possible?
Actually, all of the above. In this type of scenario, we encourage people, if they have a life and death emergency, that they continue to call 911 like they normally would. We will continue to prioritize and triage the calls. And in an extended period of time where we can't respond, we'll be providing our normal pre-arrival instructions, but also recontacting those emergency incidents throughout the storm to, again, re-triage their situation and make sure that if there's any additional instructions we can provide, that those are provided. That retriage is very important because we're going to have a number of calls that come in during that time where we can't respond. And we want to make sure that as soon as it's safe for us to do so, that we respond to the most dire, the most life-threatening emergencies as soon as we can.
So it's important to note, though, that switchboard remains active and open at the height of the storm to help people out.
Yes, ma'am. In fact, we've doubled our staffing throughout the storm. We've also placed a number of our EMS staff in there to help provide the recontacts and the retriage as the storm goes on.
Okay. And I'm going to turn now to Lisa Scarlatta with Lee Health. You're staying are a number of people on staff at the hospital. How many people do you have there now?
We have approximately, I would say, about 35% of our 14,000 people who are actually here now. And that being that we are preparing for having our full staff. We work off of a team model, both a Team A and Team B, with Team A being those first responders that come in and stay the duration of the storm, and Team B being the follow-through once we have an all-clear from the EOC. So we want to make sure that we have our focuses on the acuity and the acute care patients that are here within our hospitals. And we actually take a look and close all of our outpatient facilities. So currently, all of our lead physician group and our primary care physicians are closed, and our lead convenient care centers will also be closed as of tomorrow.
And the patients that are there at Lee Health now are the ones that are not able to go anywhere.
That is correct. But we are also a shelter for specialty needs. We work in collaboration with the Department of Health, and we share amongst all of our campuses those patients who need specialty care that cannot stay at home during any kind of an incident as such, and we will provide them shelter while they are here. So that includes those, as well as we have moved our Health Park Care Center patients into the acute care facilities for their safety as well.
And do you anticipate any people turning up at the emergency room during or shortly after the storm, even though there aren't any ambulances running?
Absolutely. You know, you always have people have the ability to come and walk in, no different than any other time of the year. You know, if history should replicate itself, I was here for Hurricane Charlie, and we saw a huge number of increased patients presenting to our ERs the day after the all clear was called for that hurricane. So I expect the same, and we are well prepared to handle that.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for your time. Lisa Scarlatta, the Chief Patient Care Officer with Lee Health, and Ben Abies, the Chief of the Lee County EMS Services. Thank you both for your services and continuing to stay here to keep us safe.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Earlier today, Governor Rick Scott held a news conference after consulting with meteorologists and emergency personnel. He had this to say about what is expected during this storm and what it might bring to the entire peninsula of Florida.
Right now, the National Hurricane Center is reporting that Hurricane Irma remains a dangerous and life-threatening Category 4 storm with winds of 155 miles per hour. The storm surge is forecast to be 3 to 10 feet. Think about that, 3 to 10 feet in many areas, which is life-threatening. Rainfall is forecast to be 8 to 12 inches, with isolated areas receiving up to 20 inches of rain. Based on what we now know, the majority of Florida will have major hurricane impacts with deadly storm surge and life-threatening winds. And we can expect this along the entire East Coast and the entire West Coast.
One topic of grave concern is Lake Okeechobee, which, when the storm turned slightly to the west, came directly in the sights of the hurricane's eye. While engineers say they feel confident the dikes and dams holding the lake together will be able to handle the storm, evacuations have nonetheless been ordered in the towns surrounding the largest freshwater lake in the continental United States. Here again is Governor Rick Scott.
I just had a briefing with the South Florida Water Management District on Lake Okeechobee. Based on recent forecasts, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been reviewing how the federally operated dike will be impacted. I spoke with Colonel Jason Kirk with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers last night, and the Corps believes there will be additional impacts from excessive wind pushing some water over the dike. While they have assured me that the structural integrity of the dike will not be compromised to keep Floridians safe, I ordered evacuations in the city surrounding the southern half of Lake Okeechobee from Lakeport to Canal Point in Hendry, Palm Beach, and Glades counties. This decision was made due to our sole focus on life safety as Hurricane Irma approaches Florida. You can find more information on these evacuations at floridadisaster.org/info.
In Hendry County, shelters opened this morning at 8 a.m., mainly for people evacuating the west side of Hendry County. Because of the evacuations of the city of Clewiston, Hooker's Point, Harlem, Flag Hole, Montura Ranch Estates, and the communities that are located within the Mid-County MSBU, which includes LaDeca, Pioneer Plantation, and Leon Dennis Subdivision, Aldon Farming Road, there will be no shelters open in Clewiston. The county is working with local and state leaders to provide additional shelters within the region. According to the Hendry County Emergency Operations Center, all residents and the evacuation zone are asked to use shelters as a last resort. If you need to evacuate and you have the means to evacuate to somewhere that's not a shelter or know someone you can stay with, they're asking people to please take advantage of these options not to fill shelters as space is limited. Current shelters for Hendry County evacuees are Country Oaks Elementary School in LaBelle, LaBelle High School, also in LaBelle, also LaBelle Middle School. There's a special needs shelter in the West Glades School, also in LaBelle. These shelters are not pet friendly. However, service animals are allowed. People with special needs must have a caretaker with them while staying at the shelter. If residents in the evacuation zone plan to evacuate one of these shelters, they're asked to bring their own bedding along with a gallon of water per person per day and enough food for 3 days, as well as any prescription medications that they may need. All evacuees are encouraged to take all important personal documents and identification. And this morning, WGCU's Quincy Walters caught up with some Lee County residents who are evacuating as part of a mandatory evacuation from mobile homes and trailers, along with all of the county's barrier islands. He's also been to a news update at the Lee County Emergency Operations Center. Quincy, first tell me what happened at that news update this morning.
Right. So Tony Shaw from the Lee County Sheriff's Department says the Sheriff's Department went to the barrier islands, which include Bonita Beach, Fort Myers Beach, Sanibel Captiva, and Pine Island, going door to door, letting people know that a mandatory evacuation is in effect. In case they didn't know, he said that if they do decide to stay, that is their choice, but to let family and friends know that they're staying and know that when the weather conditions deteriorate, emergency services will not be able to get to them.
Mm-hmm. And there's going to be another news conference apparently at the Lee Emergency Operations Center at 2:30 p.m. at which Governor Scott will be making a statement once again today. WGCU's John Davis will be there to cover that and will bring us the latest during All Things Considered later today between the hours of 4 and 6 o'clock. So where do we currently stand in terms of evacuations and what shelters are open in Lee County?
Right. So now, right now, there are 7 shelters that opened this morning. They're in that East Lee County High School in Lehigh Acres, Varsity Lakes Middle in Lehigh, Harns Marsh Middle in Lehigh, Oak Hammock Middle School in Fort Myers, Island Coast High School in Cape Coral, South Fort Myers High School in Fort Myers, and the Estero Rec Center in Estero. And so earlier you mentioned there is a mandatory evacuation for people living in mobile and manufactured homes and in Lee County. And this morning I went to an RV and trailer park right after the mandatory evacuation went into place. And I talked to people, and it didn't seem like anyone was staying there. I talked to a little six-year-old who had his Spider-Man action figure while his mom and sister were taking gallons of water into their car, and they're going to her sister's place in Lehigh, and other people were planning on going to Lehigh, and I spoke to one family who's intending to go to a shelter.
Okay, so there were families going to shelters, families going to friends and relatives in order to not populate those shelters as well.
Right.
And they're also asking that if people do have pets, to try to take those pets with you, leaving them behind. Obviously not an ideal situation.
Right. And so most shelters are equipped to handle pets, although there are two particular ones, you can check our website for that, that are equipped to, or better equipped to handle pets.
Yeah, there are some that are equipped to handle, but try to make sure that you can find one that will take your pets so you can take them with you.
Right.
Don't want to leave them behind. Well, thank you, Quincy. We'll hear more updates from you this afternoon on All Things Considered.
Thank you so much, Julie.
Those who are evacuating and heading north, the latest report from the Florida Highway Patrol reports that Interstate 75 through southwest Florida remains open and is flowing. And at this point, there is no reversing of lanes. Northbound lanes are open only to traffic traveling north, and the southbound lanes are open only to traffic traveling south. Just south of Ocala, though, near mile marker 330 on I-75, the use of the left emergency lane has been opened to traffic to keep things flowing there. That emergency lane is open for regular traffic all the way up to the Georgia state line. I-95 in St. Johns County is experiencing heavy traffic, as are State Road 91 in Ocala County and I-10 near Tallahassee and around Lake City. I-75 is also slow going to the south of Ocala there. Florida Highway Patrol encourages drivers to refer to a traffic flow website called Florida 511. That's www.fl511.com, so you can get a look at what is slowing down and if there are slowdowns. If you have a breakdown or you run out of gas, you can dial *FHP, which will contact the nearest Florida Highway Patrol office for assistance to get to you. And keep track of what stations have gas and which ones have run out. GasBuddy.com has been a resource for a lot of people, but it's also crowdsourced, so it's not guaranteed to be accurate, but it can give you a good idea of who has gas and who's run out. Mandatory evacuations in the Florida Keys started earlier this week, where some 30,000 people left the island chain ahead of Irma. Today, there are mandatory evacuations in southwest Florida, mandatory evacuation for eastern Hendry County, as we just mentioned. As of 8 o'clock this morning in Lee County, mandatory evacuations have been issued for barrier islands, including Bonita Beach, Fort Myers Beach, Sanibel, Captiva, and Pine Island, as well as all mobile and manufactured homes throughout Lee County. In Collier County, the city of Marco Island has issued a mandatory evacuation order effective immediately. In Charlotte County, evacuations have been ordered for Barrier Islands and Minnesota Key. With so many people hitting the road and looking for a safe place, where do you turn when hotels may be booked? We turn now to Airbnb of Florida Representative Tom Martinelli to tell us about the company's disaster response program for people fleeing South Florida. Tom, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me. How you doing?
We're holding tight down here. But so Airbnb is a home sharing platform for people who haven't used the service before. Could you kind of tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. It's a people-to-people platform, and it's one of the longer established sharing economy models out there. And like you said, we are opening our doors here. Our community of hosts throughout the state of Florida, predominantly in Tallahassee for this effort, are opening their homes free of charge to those Floridians who are trying to evacuate due to Hurricane Irma. And that is right when you go onto our website, www.airbnb.com. It should pop up right there if you're looking for somewhere to stay. We have about 27 listings available at the moment. They're flying off the shelf, though, as you can imagine. And so the sooner you get to book them, obviously the better. And our hosts have been very gracious in Tallahassee. They've been opening their homes free of charge, obviously welcoming in Floridians that are seeking shelter. So We're happy to just simply facilitate. You know, this is really what it comes down to is Floridians taking care of Floridians. We're just a platform.
Exactly. So what's different about the service during this disaster response program? Usually people book a room through Airbnb, a room or a house from an owner, directly from the owner, and then they pay that owner. So what's different now?
So this time around, the owners are waiving all their regular fee, right? So when somebody goes on to the disaster response page on Airbnb.com, they will see a number of listings that will be free of charge, and that is the benefit, right? We are, our hosts are opening the homes just to welcome people, not to offer anything other than shelter. And so that's the beauty of it. And again, it's just it's a testament to the care that Floridians have for each other. And it's the nice part about this is that it's all being conducted through the platform. So there's a level of security there as far as who you're getting. And then, of course, for the guests, it's just you don't have to worry about scrambling up cash or being gouged by another traditional lodging establishment. Here, folks are just opening up their homes free of charge. And thankfully, those in need will have another option to sort of seek shelter and stay safe.
Are you seeing a lot of people wanting to sign up because they want to be able to volunteer their homes? Are there people that weren't already existing Airbnb hosts, people that had not previously rented out their space? Are you seeing people kind of flooding in there trying to make themselves available?
Yeah. So luckily we have a fairly good sized community in the areas that we've activated with, which is the Tallahassee and the Pensacola area. We're actually activating in parts of Georgia as well, and that's the latest and greatest on that front. But we are seeing a sort of a spike in activating the dates, right? Sometimes folks can sort of shut down their dates and close off their dates because they themselves may be in their homes, right? But here in this case, we're seeing that if they do have a spare bedroom, they're opening it up. And so in that regard, when they come onto the platform, they're flying right off. That's why we have such low inventory right now, because we've had a good amount of homes be advertised throughout the last 24 hours since we've activated, but folks are booking them. So what's there is what you have available. That's our current available inventory. But folks are, folks are constantly getting on, and we are doing our part. We have a team of community organizers all over the state that have their respective jurisdictions, but all hands are on Florida right now to help with the evacuation efforts here for Floridians seeking shelter in the Tallahassee, Pensacola, and now Georgia area. So we're doing our part. We're trying to sort of free up as much inventory as possible by working with our host community. And we're just happy to do our part. But at the end of the day, this is really more about Floridians taking care of Floridians and really having Airbnb be the security mechanism and the facilitator to connect people with people who want to help.
Yeah, it's a little bit nicer than just walking up to somebody's front door and knocking on the door and asking if you can stay in their house. This is one way to go about it. So is there there's a geographic boundaries to this at this point?
Yeah, so we've been working with the Florida Department of Emergency Management, and they've sort of let us know that the Tallahassee, Pensacola area is, at the moment right now, the best place to go, mainly because they're higher, it's elevated higher in the Tallahassee area, and they don't expect the storm to hit the Pensacola area. So those are the areas that we've been relegated to by the Florida Department of Emergency Management and Governor Scott's team, who's, by the way, been tremendous and very supportive in this effort with us. By making the Florida Department of Emergency Management available, and it's been really an excellent collaboration, and that should be noted. But
well, it sounds like a good idea because they would know where the high ground is, and they would know. I mean, they're emergency personnel, so they would be able to direct you right place.
For all intents and purposes, they're the experts, and we're taking their lead. And those are the areas that they've sort of designated for us to activate in, and so. Working with them, and like I said, we have our team of community organizers in Washington and in Chicago that are pumping in calls to our hosts in the area. Number one, to check on their safety, and number two, if they're safe, if they'd like to host. And the overwhelming response, of course, is yes. Our hosts are just very gracious inherently, and so they want to make sure that their fellow Floridian is taken care of. And what we're seeing now is that, parts of Georgia are also being activated in Atlanta and the Athens area, and we're working with the Georgia Department of Emergency Management as well that's still unfolding. We're just now connecting with the Georgia governor, but they're taking lead from the experts in hurricane preparedness, which is the state of Florida and Governor Scott. So there is the possibility
of stepping on toes. And so when it goes into tourism and hotels and things like that, so working in concert with them. I mean, I've heard from a lot of friends that have fled up north that hotels are pretty much booked up.
Yeah. You know, I think that's the initial go-to for a lot of folks, just as, you know, traditionally speaking. But I think as the sharing economy and, you know, this model begins to grow, right, I think this is, you know, home sharing is becoming more of the norm. But that said, you know, this right now isn't about a competitive advantage. This is about putting Floridians in safe spaces. And we work, we're in conversations with the hotels associations down here just to make sure that we're doing what we can, you know, just doing the right thing, really.
To make things available, to make spaces available. And I know that as Irma is bearing down here on Florida, people in Texas are still recovering from Hurricane Harvey, and Airbnb opened up a similar disaster response program over in Texas and Louisiana after that storm. How did that go?
Yeah, it's been great. You know, one thing is to prepare for a storm, and then the aftermath is another. And so right now we're in, obviously, evacuation mode, but come Monday or Tuesday, whenever this thing passes, we will likely shift over into a sort of a responsive mode, and so figuring out how to help displaced South Floridians, and then as the storm moves up, Central and North Floridians as well. But I got to tell you, shameless plug here, but our emergency response team in Houston has been nonstop for the last week and a half, and now they're shifting all energies over to Florida. I don't know how those folks are doing it, but they are. You know, they're just nonstop, and we are working again with the experts at Florida Department of Emergency Management. But now Airbnb is sort of, while we're still working at, you know, to relieve the Harvey sort of impacts, we are now sort of moving towards prepare and figuring out how to respond to the aftermath of Irma here. And then obviously we got our eyes focused on Jose as well, should it follow the same trajectory. But you know, we are doing what we can. We have an incredibly talented team, not only for us here on the ground, on the public policy team, but our emergency management team is just A1 world class, and I'm proud to be a part, and I'm happy to have their support. And for, you know, here in Florida, as a Floridian, by the way, in South Florida, I feel safe with them helping us. And I think that those who are wondering or doubting whether or not to use Airbnb should have all the confidence in the world. Because we are doing what we can. We have a lot of resources, and we're working very diligently and intelligently with the experts and with our host community to make sure that all Floridians are taken care of to the extent possible. So we're here. We're doing what we can.
Over there in Texas, you helped over 1,000 people find shelter, and the New York Times profiled some of the Texans who relied on Airbnb during that tragedy there. Can you tell me a little bit about the stories that you've heard about the individual people and how these free listings have really had an impact?
Yeah, I mean, candidly, my efforts have been in Florida, but I've been in contact with the Houston team. A lot of my team here actually went over to help relieve, and now they're stuck in northern parts of Georgia. But what I've heard is that it's been an incredibly humbling experience for both the host and the guest. And I think that we as a platform, as one of the leaders in the sharing economy model, you know, what we've done is master the art of trust. And I think that that's magnified in times of crisis. And if we can just help one person get a warm meal and a roof over their head in the aftermath of what can seem to be as a tragedy or a total loss, you know, I think that's what we are happy just simply playing a small part in facilitating.
And
I think that those stories are, I think you probably heard them all, you know, and so we're happy to do what we can.
So I want to ask you one last question before we go, Tom. I know you mentioned you're from Florida. You're getting out of Miami yourself right now. What are you seeing there? Are people all pretty much evacuating over from Miami?
Yeah, so as a South Floridian, we're fairly conditioned to these environmental circumstances, but I'm very proud of my community personally because for the last 3 or 4 days, folks have been really taking this seriously. They've been taking the proper precautions. Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez has been incredibly supportive of just getting things done here and making sure that all that folks aren't getting gouged by whether it's gas or lumber to help with the plywood. Floridians are really taking the proper precautions, and South Floridians in particular, Miamians, are being very helpful. I can't tell you how many of my friends have signed up to volunteer with their fellows, you know, with the AARP down here. Mm-hmm. What we're doing, what my friends and my family are doing for the seniors on our block is just incredible. We are obviously a major community of senior citizens, and so
yeah.
We're really, aside from taking care of ourselves, we're taking care of each other and really keeping the peace here as much as possible. I really
okay.
gotta tell you, the local retailers have been terrific about restocking all their supplies, whether it's lumber.
Yeah,
water,
we're all in the same boat doing all that. So we'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank you, Tom Martinelli, Florida Policy Director for Airbnb. Coming up, storm surge and floodwaters. What do they do to our drinking water, and why does the water service go out at all? We'll talk with the Florida Department of Health about the dangers that could lurk after the storm in well water, flood water, and public water supplies. Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. The potential fallout from a storm the size of Hurricane Irma is widespread power outages and water service interruptions. But when the lights flicker back on and the water starts to flow again, is that water safe? We asked environmental scientist Jamie Cook with the Florida Department of Health. She specializes in water quality and water testing. One of the first things that everybody does whenever they hear a hurricane's coming is they run to the store and they get a bunch of bottled water, and that's for fear of water running out. They say fill your bathtub with water so you can put it in the tank of your toilet so it will continue to work when the water isn't flowing to your house. So I want to ask you, what causes the water to not work?
Well, you know, in areas that are hit by tropical storms, hurricanes, or even storm surge, the water treatment plants may not be operating. They may have damage to their own pipes, their own electricity, and even flooding can damage water lines. So that is why it is so recommended that people go out, they get bottled water, they fill up their bathtubs, they get whatever they need to have water supply for at least 3 days. Because hopefully by that time we can get electricity back to water treatment plants, that water will start working again. But the other thing to keep in mind, especially down here in Florida, is there are a lot of people on private wells that if their power goes out, their well is not going to work. So they won't have any water at all. So again, we strongly encourage residents to have a bottled water supply, fill up their bathtubs with water for, toilets, sinks, things like that. So that if they are without water, whether they're on a private well or the public utility water supply, they have water to sustain them for that time period.
So when the water comes back on, is that water safe immediately, or do you need to let it run for a while?
That's going to depend. If you are on a well, we would absolutely recommend to people that they disinfect their entire system, including their wellhead, prior to using that water. It is a process for disinfecting the well and the system. But for the public water supply, public announcements will be made and put out to radio stations, TV stations, news outlets, things like that, letting people know if the water is safe for them to start consuming. They'll have to go through the process of checking their piping. They'll do bacteria tests on their water, and we'll put out announcements to their customers letting them know whether the water is safe or not.
Okay, so the water companies will be letting the people getting the water know whether that water coming out of the faucet is okay?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so how does stuff get into the water? Is it because the pipes at the treatment plant could get compromised? And what is it that gets in there?
Typically, it depends. There's a lot of our water down here is well water. And so when flooding occurs, around the wellhead areas, there is the risk of bacteria and things like that getting into the well system, getting into the piping. that can work its way through the system and end up inside a user's home. As for water treatment companies, they're going to have to worry about loss of pressure. Loss of pressure allows for bacteria to be introduced into the water. And again, pipes breaking. If a pipe breaks, anything could happen at that point. Anything could get into that pipe and contaminate the water supply.
What kind of bacteria seems to be the big thing that you're talking about. What kind of bacteria are we dealing with here?
Typically, we're dealing with bacteria in what are known as coliform bacteria. Typically, the big one that people think of when they think of coliform bacteria is E. coli or fecal coliform bacteria, which causes gastrointestinal illnesses in people. So that's why we're saying that, don't necessarily assume that the water is safe to drink until you've had confirmation from your water utility or you've gone through the disinfection process and had your water tested afterwards. Don't just assume that because you have power, your water is okay to drink.
Do people need to ask for their water to be tested at their home, or do they need to go get their own test?
If people are connected to public water supply, county, city, public utilities, the utility themselves will do their testing before the water even leaves the plant. So they'll know immediately. As for wells, they can contact any health department. So I know you have listeners all over the region. They can contact their health department and have their water tested after the storm, after their power's back on, and after the flooding has started to subside.
Okay. Is there anything else that we should be concerned about possibly getting into private wells besides bacteria, for example, chemical runoff or anything like that?
Chemicals could be a concern in areas, especially maybe areas that have high agriculture, high pesticides. If they're, near a chemical plant, things like that, yes, there absolutely could be a risk of runoff. And again, I would recommend that they contact their local health department for testing and additional information about any contaminants that might be in their well.
Yeah, that would be something that's a pretty hyper-local concern. Another big concern coming up right now is with the current track projected to put this hurricane over Lake Okeechobee, which is a giant body of water. That could potentially send some of that water out. I know you're in Collier County rather than Hendry County, but what kind of things would you suggest that people returning from evacuating from around Lake Okeechobee maybe look out for when it comes to getting things back to normal and trying to get their water running again?
Floodwaters, definitely. We definitely do not recommend that people go into floodwaters, whether it's driving their car or walking through it, and they definitely should not be playing in floodwaters. Some other things are, again, that could cause major flooding, especially for homes that are on wells, that if their wellhead area is flooded, there is a very high risk that their well and subsequent treatment system could become contaminated. And when the flooding has subsided, we recommend they go through the disinfection process and have their water tested by their health department.
And you mentioned briefly a little bit about playing around in floodwaters. I know a couple weeks ago when Hurricane Harvey was in Houston and we were having a lot of rain here in Southwest Florida, there were a lot of videos popping up of people with rafts out in their street, out in front of their house, and playing around in those kinds of floodwaters. What's going on in that water? Is that stuff safe?
I'm glad you asked. Floodwater can be very easily contaminated with both bacteria and viruses that are out in the environment. So we strongly recommend that people do not wade through, play in, float in floodwaters. Anybody that has open cuts or sores, that could be direct introduction of any bacteria or virus into your body. But additionally, if there are sewage leaks, a sewer system pipe breaks or a septic system fails, sewage could start leaking into that floodwater and contaminate that floodwater with sewage. So, again, we strongly recommend that people do not play in, walk through floodwaters.
Well, and not only that, but then, you know, the wild animals that are around here and snakes and all that.
Absolutely. Absolutely, because you're absolutely correct. Snakes, alligators, anything could be in that floodwater that you may not see depending on the depth. So, you know, there's the concerns with the wildlife, and then there's the concerns with sewage, bacteria, viruses, things like that being contaminating that water.
Also out near Lake Okeechobee, but the I know we have alligators everywhere, but that area, once if that gets flooded out there, that should be something to certainly keep your eye on. You know, we've heard a lot about throughout life the 48-hour boil order. Is that something that you foresee being implemented here?
Depending on the infrastructure of the system, you know, where the storm hits and what damage it does, it very well could be a possibility, and residents should be encouraged to, you know, listen for those public announcements if they are on the public water supply. Listen for, you know, when to boil water notices, when to when they can rescind those boil water notices, and also FloridaHealth.gov, the Department of Health's website, will be posting boil water notices from around the state as they become known to Tallahassee. They will start publishing those. So for residents that still can have internet or cell phone access, they can go on to FloridaHealth.gov and find out if their area does have a boil water notice.
You know, earlier today I was listening to a meteorologist talking about hurricanes and about how the most deadly part of a hurricane is typically the water because of the flooding. But it sounds like the water can also maintain that power well after the storm has gone if some of these, the pipes and plants and wells end up getting contaminated because of the floodwaters.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we've seen areas that, you know, are still flooded from just our regular storms that, you know, people have been living in flood conditions for months in Southwest Florida. So, you know, it could happen anywhere down here that, you know, it might be the nicest neighborhood, but it may end up flooding out for several weeks. And people definitely need to be taking precautions and preparing themselves now.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time. I appreciate you talking with us and giving us the information about our water systems and private wells. Jamie Cook, with the environmental scientist with the Florida Department of Health. I really appreciate your time today.
You are welcome. And I definitely encourage all of our residents to be prepared, stay safe, and get in touch with their local health department if they have questions after the storm has passed.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Another hurricane-related danger after a storm passes through arrives when people fire up those generators. Florida health officials say after storms and natural disasters, there's an increase of carbon monoxide poisoning cases. WGCU's Jessica Mazzaros tells us why and how to prevent it ahead of Hurricane Irma.
Andrea McKinney with the Florida Department of Health says people tend to make the mistake of running portable generators and cooking with charcoal grills in their homes when power goes out during a natural disaster.
After storms and natural disasters, we can see an increase of carbon monoxide poisoning due to the use of generators and charcoal grills around the home.
She says carbon monoxide poisoning is the leading cause of poison-related deaths in the U.S. The FDOH website says the most common symptoms of CO poisoning include headache, nausea, fatigue, weakness, abdominal pain, confusion, and dizziness. McKinney recommends residents install carbon monoxide alarms, especially near where people are sleeping.
Those are kind of used as a backup. They're not a replacement for the proper use, maintenance of any fuel-burning appliance or gas-powered portable equipment, but it can help with alarming you if carbon monoxide has built up in a home.
McKinney says portable generators should be at least 20 feet away from homes. They should not be near air conditioners or ventilators that can bring the carbon monoxide into the home. She also says opening windows to air out a building is not going to prevent the buildup of life-threatening levels of carbon monoxide. Jessica Mazzaros, WGCU News.
While home and hearth are of paramount importance to individuals, wide swaths of land all across the Florida Peninsula are home to livestock, citrus groves, and produce farms. Jessica Mazzaros checked in with University of Florida's IFAS office in Hendry County. Here's that conversation.
What is growing in Florida, at least in your area right now?
Southwest Florida, we produce a lot of vegetables throughout the fall, winter, and spring season, and we've really just started preparing land in early August, laying down plastic to plant those vegetables on, and planting itself actually started in mid-August, around the 15th of August. So we have 3 weeks of planting cycle, or 3 weeks worth of plants in the ground since that time.
Can you describe which kinds of, or maybe just list a few different vegetables that we're
talking about? Some of the more important vegetables in our area would be tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, squash, melons. We do grow some herbs, and I know there's some herbs in the ground as well.
What kind of production does this create, like this, these crops that you've just planted and you're 3 weeks in? So what is the end product like? How much product do you have at the end of it?
Well, it's hard to say precisely because planting starts slowly and ramps up as we get into September. So I'd say maybe 10% of the crop, maybe 15% of the crop is in the ground for the fall season, probably closer to 10. So it's really, really fairly small at this point. More important, we have a lot of the plastic that will be down for the fall crop, and we probably have 30% or more of our plastic laid in the area.
Plastic is in, that's how you prepare for the planting, right?
Right. The plastic mulch is what we plant the vegetables into. It helps protect our fertilizers from leaching out when we get heavy rain. It provides weed control, and it helps moderate the environment around the plants.
So what's the conversation like when a storm such as Hurricane Irma is threatening the state and farmers? What's the conversation like now?
Well, there's not a lot you could do right now. And people actually, even though, you know, the storm is coming, are still planting this week. Again, you have to think in terms of markets. You know, they plan on a weekly basis to provide market projections, you know, starting at the end of October. So if you don't plant something this week and the storm doesn't happen to come, you're not going to have product that corresponding week, you know, in November. So you're going to plant and take a risk that the crop comes through, and if it doesn't, well, it's a loss.
What kind of damage would have to be done from the hurricane in order to categorize it as a loss?
Well, the plants could be washed away. They can be blown away. When Hurricane Wilma came through, I remember seeing, you know, the entire, you know, field of plastic, 100 acres of plastic, and all the plastic just piled up on one corner of the field with all the plants torn out of the ground. In other cases, the plastic remained intact, but the plants were sandblasted. So you had a tomato plant that was basically just a stick with no leaves left on it. We had other situations where fields were flooded if, you know, you get intense rains. And that's one of the things we're doing right now. You know, all of our fields and groves are surrounded by canals and ditches to help move water off because we get heavy rains even in a normal year. So we have the ability to move a lot of water. So we're drawing those canals and ditches down so that they have a lot of room to take excess water. People are making sure they have adequate fuel in their fuel tanks to operate those pumps. You know, so in case power goes out, they are independent of the electric grid. Those are the kind of, you know, moving equipment to safe places, taking photographs. And this is something, you know, I recommend to all my farmers, ranchers, grove owners, take a lot of photographs before, because if something bad happens, you're going to need those photographs before and after to prove what you had before for your insurance claim or your disaster claim.
Let's say worst case scenario, there's a total loss. Is it because we're so early in the planting season, maybe it's not so financially devastating?
It would be better. It would be better for people in the vegetable industry. For citrus, obviously, if the fruit blows off the tree, if we get winds that severe, or we had in Wilma, some trees actually blew over. You know, the fruit is already formed on those trees for this fall's crop, so that will be worse. Sugarcane, we grow a lot of, especially over in the Clewiston area, into Palm Beach County. Again, cane will usually survive, but it'll blow over and lodge onto the ground. If it gets flooded, it can rot, and it will make it difficult to impossible to harvest, so we could see losses there as well.
What stage, if you can talk to that, are we in sugar? So what's going on with the with sugar?
Sugar, cane? We're just a few weeks. We'll start harvesting sugar in a few weeks from now.
So it's almost finished right now.
Crop is almost mature for this season, yes.
And are sugar growers concerned because they're so close to being able to harvest?
As I say, sugar is pretty resilient. It won't blow away, but it often will lodge and lay down, so you will incur some loss. If you get a lot of sunshine and dry weather after, it'll try to stand back up. But again, you will lose something. The facilities as well. I mean, we have warehouses, we have mills, we have packing houses. And again, we saw a lot of damage to some of those facilities following Wilma.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to mention before we conclude regarding maybe any kind of preparation or...
As I say, you know, make sure your family's safe. Make sure you have lots of photographs. You know, follow advice from, you know, your emergency management district and folks like that. I think most of our farmers have... This is not their first rodeo. They've been through this many times. They're resilient, and we hope for the best. Livestock, we do have quite a bit of livestock. Usually the best thing to do with livestock is just leave them alone. They will find high places. They will go through a storm. If they're in a building, if you have homeowners that have horses or small animals, oftentimes it's better just to turn them out into a pasture and get them out of the barn, because they'll get injured if the barn blows apart. But as I say, they'll find some thick bushes and they'll take care of themselves usually.
Thank you so much for your time today. I hope that you stay safe during the storm.
Thank you. You too, Jessica.
WGCU will continue coverage of Hurricane Irma as it approaches throughout the weekend. We have a dedicated team that will be here throughout, so you can depend on us for reports as the storm makes landfall and passes through Florida. In the meantime, you can also check WGCUnews.org, where you will find useful links to any of the subjects we covered in today's show. We also have links there to all of the counties within our listening area's emergency operations centers. On those pages, you will find lists of areas that have been evacuated, shelters that are open and operational, and any other information that county emergency officials have released. That's the most immediate way to get the information that is local to your community. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.